You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Kick-Ass News is brought to you by Capella University. Are you considering a doctorate to help you lead at the top of your field and contribute to your profession in more meaningful ways? Capella University can help. With flexible online degree programs and scholarship opportunities for select programs, Capella can help support your goals from beginning to end. Learn more at capella.edu/kick. Support for today's show comes from the Life is Good Ping Podcast. Join co-founders of Life is Good, Bert and John Jacobs, as they talk to influential musicians, athletes, business leaders, and everyday people about the role of optimism in their lives. They'll also end each episode with a ping pong charity challenge where the winner gets to donate to their charity of choice. The Life is Good Ping Podcast kicked off Thursday, June 13th with the legendary Ringo Starr. Subscribe now on Stitcher, Spotify, or iTunes and add some good vibes to your day. And now, on with the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. On August 12, 2017, neo-Nazis and other white supremacists unleashed violence and mayhem in the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia, killing three people, injuring many more, and giving lie to the myth that Americans lived in a post-racial society. For then-Governor of Virginia, Terry McAuliffe, it was the most difficult test during his time in office and a day marked by personal tragedy. Now, Governor McAuliffe gives a behind-the-scenes account of this infamous chapter in our history and shows how we can prevent other Charlottesvilles in a new memoir titled Beyond Charlottesville, Taking a Stand Against White Nationalism. And on today's podcast, he shares his biggest worries in the weeks leading up to the infamous Unite the Right rally, why local authorities didn't take those concerns nearly seriously enough, and why he believes the ACLU shares some of the blame for failing to prevent the violence. He opens up about the tragic loss that his own family suffered on that fateful day, and voices his anger that the public image of Virginia was tarnished by racist agitators from out of state. Then he discusses his phone call with President Trump the day of the rally and the offensive public statements that the president made about what happened. Terry McAuliffe also talks about his decision to run for governor of Virginia when pundits predicted that he'd run in just about any other state except the one he called home, and he recalls his efforts to bring Virginia into the 21st century and expand voting rights. Finally, this former chairman of the DNC weighs in on the Democratic debates and what he thinks Democrats are looking for in 2020. Coming up with Terry McAuliffe in just a moment. Terry McAuliffe served as chairman of the Democratic National Committee from 2001 to 2005, co-chair of President Bill Clinton's re-election campaign in 2006, and chair of Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign in 2008. From 2014 to 2018, he was governor of Virginia and served as chair of the National Governors Association from 2016 to 2017. The violence and hate that erupted during the infamous 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville became the most challenging crisis during his time as governor, and now he writes about it in a new book titled Beyond Charlottesville, Taking a Stand Against White Nationalism. Terry McAuliffe, welcome to the show.
Ben, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into Charlottesville, I want to give folks a little bit of a background on you. You've had this long career in Democratic politics, long relationship with the Clintons, but when you started thinking of running for office yourself, apparently you say that everyone speculated you'd run for governor of New York or Florida, just about anywhere but the state where you'd spent much of your life, Virginia. Why do you think That's right.
Well, it was interesting. Dorothy and I had moved there 20 years before. We wanted to raise our five children. But I had, you know, been on television a lot and people knew I was from New York. I owned a bunch of businesses in Florida. And when I announced I was running for governor, they sort of said, well, this is a surprise to us. We thought you were going to be running in a different state. But, you know, as I like to say, this is, you know, I didn't determine where I was going to live and where I was born. My mother determined that for me. But when I had to make a decision, I chose Virginia. It's a great state. And I just thought we needed to move it in a new direction. It's an old southern state. When I became governor, I inherited a record deficit, turned it into a record surplus, record jobs. But I became a bulwark to protect individual rights. I was the first governor to perform a gay marriage after the Supreme Court ruled. I restored more felon rights than any governor in American history. I did more pardons than any governor of Virginia, kept my women's health clinics open. You know, I was a very progressive governor, but also a very pro-jobs governor. And at the end of the term, the state was in the best shape it had ever been in.
Mm-hmm. And I think you say that your stated goal when you took office was to drag Virginia into the 21st century. When you look at how companies and film productions are now threatening to flee states like Georgia and Missouri over restrictions on women's rights, do you see a greater urgency for states like Virginia to get with the times? Does it become more than just a social issue, but a matter of economic survival?
Oh, no question, Ben. So if you go back to 2013, when I ran for governor, Virginia had just passed the transvaginal bill, which made Virginia a laughingstock on national television. Remember, Rachel Maddow and Jon Stewart every night talked about it. They had passed legislation to shut the 25 women's health clinics down in Virginia. Horrible anti-gay legislation. I got elected in 2013, sworn in January 14. I'm very proud we ended all of that. I fired the Board of Health. All the women's clinics stayed open, opened a couple more, made Virginia open and welcoming to everybody, had a whole tourism effort for the LGBTQ community. We became a different state. And because of the open welcoming, I was able to recruit over 1,100 new companies to move to Virginia. The Amazon bid, which, you know, I wrote the bid, Amazon came to Virginia. Facebook, Microsoft, Google, all invested huge amounts of money in the Commonwealth of Virginia. I was able to recruit Nestle Corporation to move out of L.A. to move to Virginia. And you make a valid point, Ben, because if you're not open and welcoming, you are not going to be able to recruit those 21st century companies. I'm very proud from when I started in Virginia and 4 years later when I left, it is now one of the most progressive states in the country, a southern state that is leading the nation on cybersecurity, data analytics, and unmanned systems.
But it is an interesting state because I feel like it's as purple as it gets. I mean, socially and politically, Virginia's sort of hard to pin down because, yes, it's the South, but it's not the Deep South. And in a lot of ways, it is progressive and a leader in tech, home to Fortune 500 companies. Yeah. And yet, like you mentioned, it's been responsible for some very backwards restrictions on things like women's rights and voting rights. As someone who ran for governor twice, what's the secret to winning in a state like Virginia? Maybe there's a teachable moment here for some presidential candidates.
Well, that's a great question. I've always believed that when you run for office or anything you ought to do, you ought to stick to what you believe in. Ben, I'm not a guy who ever takes polls. Mm-hmm. I'm not a guy who puts my finger up in the air. When I ran for governor in 2013, as I say, you know, everybody tried to, you know, get along and nobody wanted to ruffle feathers. I'm the first Democratic nominee for governor to get an F rating from the NRA. The NRA is based in Virginia.
And it's an open carry state, right?
Yeah. I said I wish I had a lower rating. I ran television commercials. I told women I would be a brick wall to protect their rights and stop all of the insanity that the Republicans in the legislature had done. I believe I was the first candidate or statewide official in the entire South to come out for marriage equality. My point is, these are the things I believed in. Run on what you believe in. And if you win, you lose. But you got to stand for convictions on the things that you actually believe in. Mm-hmm. And that's why when I ran for governor, I broke a 44-year trend to get elected. Whatever party wins the presidential election, we have the elections after the governor's race. whoever wins the presidential, the other party wins the governor's race for 44 straight years. Hmm. I broke that. Statewide controlled all three, Republicans controlled all three statewide offices. When I ran, when I got elected, we controlled all the statewides. And under my 4 years, we picked up a record amount of House of Delegates seats. We actually picked up 17 seats in my 4 years, which is the most in 144 years. We are a Democratic state today. Our problem, though, Ben, is we have elections every year. This year, our entire General Assembly's up. So people have to keep coming out year in and year out. But in a presidential year with a high turnout, we're as blue can be. We're the only state that went for Hillary in the South.
The governor in your state is limited to only one term. So how did you keep from being a lame duck? Did you find that you had to try extra hard to work with the legislature to get things done?
My personality was that I was going to do – I think for some, they say they got to really lean in because I only got 4 years. You know, that's just my personality. I was going to do that whether I had 4 years or I had 100 years. It didn't matter to me. But, you know, I tried to work with the legislature. I got 70-plus percent of my governor's legislation passed through a Republican legislature. Outside of the social insanity that they had, the anti-women, anti-gay stuff, outside of that, you know, we got along pretty well. We had the largest investment in K-12 in the history of Virginia. We did it in a bipartisan way. My economic development projects, I worked with the Republicans. We were the first state to end veteran homelessness in our state. So I worked with the Republicans on a lot of issues. The problem, Ben, is they get caught up in these gerrymandered districts. Mm-hmm. And they're terrified of the Tea Party that they'll show up in a small primary and defeat them. Yeah. And we got to get rid of these gerrymandered districts. We got to get people back to the place where we actually can work together to get things done for the folks we actually represent. I know that's a novel idea.
You mentioned a moment ago that as governor, you took on the ban on felon voting in your state, something that's often seen as unfairly disenfranchising minorities. You signed an executive order to restore voting rights, but then it was shot down in court based on, a pretty flimsy argument.
Yep.
Your response was then to do something pretty extraordinary. You individually signed over 200,000 individual requests to have voting rights restored.
That's right.
As time-consuming as something like that must have been, you just weren't going to be deterred, were you?
Well, first of all, you understand, in America, Ben, so your listeners understand, so in America today, in two states, you vote, you don't lose your voting rights. You actually vote when you're in prison, in Maine and Vermont. In 14 states, you vote, you get your vote back the second you walk out of prison. In the remaining states, you vote when you're out of prison, done with probation and parole. Virginia was one of 10 states that disenfranchised these felons. Virginia was one of three states that permanently disenfranchised it. So you lost your voting rights forever. And remember, in Virginia, if you steal something over $200 or you commit anything over $200 is a felony. So if you steal groceries, $202, and you're 18 years old, you lose your voting rights for the rest of your life. That's just not right. And in 1902, in Virginia, and really the 10 states remaining are the southern states. This is remnant of Jim Crow. In these states, I mean, it's just almost hard to actually believe how these poor people were treated. But in these states, you know, they don't get their rights back. I didn't think that was fair. I tried to work with my legislature. They wouldn't pass legislation. And it goes back to 1902, Ben, when a state senator by the name of Glass put it in our Constitution. And he said that day in the Constitution, he put this in our Capitol in Richmond, which was built by Thomas Jefferson. I am doing this, quote, to eliminate the darky from being a political factor in Virginia.
Unbelievable.
So I said, I won't tolerate it. So I did an executive order. Supreme Court sued me. I mean, the leadership of the House and Senate sued me, went to the Virginia Supreme Court, which is appointed by the legislature, one of two states. But the Constitution of Virginia is very clear. I have the authority to do it. But the Supreme Court came out and ruled against me and said, no, we're not going to let them do it because no governor's done it before. Well, you know, Ben, that's not a constitutional theory. You know, we haven't impeached any Virginia governor either. That doesn't mean you can't do it. I mean, it was just so flimsy. And then the New York Times and LA Times and Washington Post just ridiculed the court. And they said the governor has to do it individually. So I said, fine, get all 206,000 petitions. I'm going to sign every damn one myself. I don't care how long it takes me. And they sued me again. They quickly went back to court to stop me from doing that. And they sued me for contempt of court. Now the Supreme Court wanted out. And they said, no. He's doing it individually. It's the right thing to do. So we did it for 206,000 felons. And here's the best part, Ben. Since I was under court order doing it individually, I took every petition, put it in a with a seal of the Commonwealth and my signature. I put them all in individual envelopes, mailed it to all 206,000 with a voter registration form and a stamped self-addressed envelope to mail it back. The Republicans screwed themselves because they allowed me to have the largest voter registration drive in Virginia history.
That's amazing, because I imagine that, you know, if you had just signed an executive order, and a lot of people probably wouldn't have even known that they could vote again.
Right.
But, you know, getting that individual envelope in the mail probably did a lot of good.
You're exactly right. When I did it, you know, we did it in the Capitol and the place went crazy. But, you know, a lot of these felons aren't watching TV and you know, aren't listening to radio. But you know, when you get a package with the governor's signature and the seal with a voter registration form, you know that, boom, I got the the bottom line has been, every day someone comes up to me, tears in their eyes. Thank you. You made me a full citizen of the Commonwealth. I just can't tell you how depressing and disheartening it is for, you know, fathers used to tell me on election day they'd go to a polling booth and hope they could find one of those I voting stickers and put it on and go home and show their kids because they were embarrassed to say they couldn't vote.
Now, you also have some pretty harsh words for President Trump in this book, but you say initially as governor, you tried to have a pretty good working relationship with him. What were you hoping that you and the president could achieve for your state?
Hey, listen, when he got elected, I felt as the governor of Virginia, I was also chairman of the governors, in charge of all the governors, the National Governors Association.
Right.
With a new president coming in, who I had known for 20 years, I figured let's work together on infrastructure. I mean, we've got a mess on our hands. I wanted to work with him on health care. And he always, when I met with him, Ben, always agreed with me when I met with him. And then literally within 24 hours, he would go the other way. But as governor of one of the largest defense states in America, we have 27 military installations. We have the largest naval base in the world in Virginia. The Pentagon, the CIA, Quantico, Marines, all in Virginia. You know, I wanted to work with the president to make sure that we were getting the funding we needed to grow the assets we had in Virginia. But I tried and tried and tried. The man has no moral core. He does not believe in anything. I always say Trump's not a Republican. Trump's Trump.
Yeah.
It's all about what's good for him.
Yeah, in fact, there's a good moment in here where you recall that you would run into him in the years leading up to 2016, and he talked about running for president, but still wasn't sure whether he was going to run as a Republican or Democrat, right?
Listen, I was used to give money when I was chair of the DNC. He was pro-choice, pro-gay rights his whole life. This whole thing is a charade. He just wanted to determine how he could win. I go back to my point. Trump is about Trump. If Trump thought he could win as a Democrat, he would have run as a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
If he thought, you know, he thought forever to run as an independent for years because Jesse Ventura had done it and that was his role model. And, you know, that didn't work out. So he ran as a Republican. And, you know, it's shocking. I tell a great story in the book. The first time he's in his first big official dinner is to host the governors, our annual meeting early February in Washington. I'm sitting next to him, of course, as the chair of the governors. And he leans over to me at one point and he says, you know, Terry, puts his arm on mine and says, can you believe I'm here? And he's looking around the room with all the beautiful paintings and Abraham Lincoln and Washington. And I looked at him, put my arm on his and said, in all deference, Mr. President, no. I can't believe you're here, sir.
Yeah, you mentioned a moment ago that you knew the guy for 20 years before he ran for president.
Yeah.
And you recount this weird moment when you and President Bill Clinton, or I think at the moment, ex-President Bill Clinton, were playing golf at one of his clubs. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, I mean, so as I say, he'd been a Democrat. I think Bill and Hillary went to their wedding or whatever. And
right.
So we were down golfing. Actually, it happened to be a weekend. I remember, Ben, it was like yesterday. It was my birthday. And I was down staying at my friend's house. The president and I were down there. He had some things to do. I had to do. But, you know, we sat up 3, 4, 5 in the morning like he and I used to do, just, you know, jacking the jaw, talking and so forth. And I had to be up like at 6 to go on CNN. I was chairman of the party, Democratic National Committee at that point. And we went golfing after that. So 9 o'clock, we roll over to the golf course. It's Trump's course. And it's nice. He's got a nice cake for me for my birthday. I think it was my 44th birthday, I think. And it was nice. We golfed. He's a pretty good golfer. Well, anyways, at the end we finish, and We go, Clinton and I go into the pro shop, and Trump goes away for about 10 minutes, and he comes back, and we're walking down to the motorcade to get in, and Trump hands Clinton this big envelope of a big manila envelope, and President Clinton opens it up, and there's all these pictures of us golfing, of, you know, on the golf course, and they're all signed, to Bill, best wishes, Donald. And all I could think of is, what does the President of the United States of America do with autographed pictures of Donald Trump?
Yeah.
I mean, really?
Yeah.
But I mean, what an ego.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Here's the most powerful man in the world, and Donald's giving him autographed pictures. Yeah. Like, you know, we're supposed to be impressed. I tell you, it's something.
Well, you've had your differences with President Trump on a number of issues like health care, the Muslim ban, and illegal immigration. Yep. But then came Charlottesville. And I want to talk about the lead up to that. First of all, that statue of Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville is hardly exceptional. I was surprised to read about how many Confederate statues and monuments you have in Virginia. How do those numbers compare to the monuments to other wars in your state?
You know, I think people are going to find that fascinating when they read the book. And I go through the whole history of the monuments, which, let's be clear, Ben, they are offensive to the African-American community.
Sure.
As governor, I used executive authority. I took the Confederate flag off the license plate.
Right,
to the African-American
right.
community, this is a remembrance they were fighting for slavery. And they can today say whatever they want, but it is just plain offensive. These folks were traitors to the United States of America. So let's think of Virginia. The Revolutionary War started in Virginia at St. John's Church when Patrick Henry gave the famous speech to Jefferson and Washington, "Give me liberty or give me death." Mm-hmm. The Revolutionary War ended in Virginia at the Battle of Yorktown when they defeated General Cornwallis, and that was the end of it. So pretty significant. I think we have two or three statues of the Revolutionary War. The war to end all wars, World War I, World War II, biggest loss we had, less than a dozen.
Really?
The Confederate Civil War, 358.
Wow. Were most of those built during Reconstruction? Yeah.
Many of them were built, good point, during massive resistance, well after the Civil War had ended in 1865. And they're just horrible remembrance, and we have so many of them. And as I say, they just plain are offensive. And what I say in Virginia is local jurisdictions cannot make a decision on their own. State law prevails, and the Republicans in the legislature are never going to take them down. I think localities ought to make a decision. If they want to put them in a cemetery or they want to put them in a museum, they ought to do that. But you know what? I worked hard to make Virginia open and welcoming and as diverse as possible, because diversity, you know, it's a mosaic tile. It makes you stronger. And when you have offensive symbols, people don't want to come to your state, or they don't want to stay in your state. And that's just something I can tell you as governor is not what I wanted.
And when the city council of Charlottesville voted to take down the statue, it was a fairly unremarkable event, didn't get much press coverage. So how did it go from this non-event to this big media controversy and rallying cry for racists?
Well, earlier they'd also, some of the leadership of Charlottesville said they wanted to be the center of resistance to President Trump, which I can tell you as a governor, I don't want to hear that. I want to hear about being the center of innovation or technology.
Yeah.
I mean, Charlottesville is a beautiful city with the University of Virginia and a really hub and working high on technology and so forth and 21st century economies. And then, of course, they took the vote. And I knew, Ben, as soon as they did that vote to take down the statue, that it wouldn't be long. And sure enough, shortly thereafter, the Unite the Right rally permit was filed. And what I unfortunately take exception to for the city in Charlottesville, you have 10 days when someone applies for a permit to do something, to issue it or decline it. Or, you know, if you want to put restrictions on the time, the place, that you shouldn't carry poles or weapons or, you know, you can't wear masks. The city of Charlottesville didn't do anything. So if you don't do anything, it's automatically approved. And so we had on our hands a permit for a 12 noon to 5 rally at this tiny little park, Emancipation Park. And I knew right then I had trouble. I called my state police and told them to fire up our fusion center. And so for several months, we monitored. We had undercover operations going. I was working with DHS and FBI. But we knew through social media and our own investigative work that these folks were all told to bring weapons and to come and to harm people. We knew that ahead of time.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe when we come back in just a minute. studying for standardized tests doesn't have to be stressful, boring, or expensive. Magoosh Online Test Prep provides students everywhere with effective, accessible, and enjoyable test prep for exams like the GRE, GMAT, LSAT, MCAT, and SAT. At Magoosh.com, you'll find tons of practice questions, study schedules, video lessons, and access to an expert tutor team if you need extra help. If you're retaking a test, Magoosh offers a score improvement guarantee. If you don't improve, you'll get your money back. Study materials are always up to date and super relevant to the questions you'll see on the actual tests. Students who've used Magoosh love it. One student who used Magoosh to improve his GMAT verbal score by 6 points says, "My quant skills were already good, but I needed to improve my verbal score. The question sets and explanations are amazing." Visit Magoosh.com and enter the promo code KICKASS for a 15% off discount. That's Magoosh.com and promo code KICKASS for 15% off. And now, back to the podcast. And at the state level, your Fusion Task Force and your Secretary of Public Safety seem to be on top of this well in advance of the event.
Yep.
And making recommendations to the local authorities in Charlottesville. Were they responsive to your advice? Did you feel like the city government was sufficiently prepared for what was coming?
Absolutely not. And I talk at length about this. And then, you know, listen, it's hard to talk about. But we kept telling them that this is a volatile situation. I actually put a memo in the book of my conversation with the mayor, what we needed to do there, the city manager, the chief of police. And I think, Ben, one thing that happened, about 6 weeks before, there had been a Ku Klux Klan rally. And the Ku Klux Klan, it was about 50 folks. And I told the state police, and I got, you know, let them walk through the street. They literally will stop at the first fast food burger joint, and you'll never hear, you know, that'll be the end of it. They'll go home and be quiet. It was 50 guys. Well, unfortunately, a lot more counter-protesters showed up. They chased the KKK into a parking garage. They wouldn't let them out. The state police fired 3 canisters of tear gas to disperse the crowd and so forth. Well, unfortunately, the overreaction from Charlottesville was, you know, police brutality. I mean, you get the idea. But at the end of the day, their job was to keep people safe. So I think the attitude going forward is, well, we don't want to be a militaristic state. This wasn't anything. This was about keeping your citizens safe. But, you know, there were no blockades around the roads. There should have been. They should never have allowed the permit in its present form. The Emancipation Park is a very small park, Ben. And the idea you're going to have 1,000 armed neo-Nazis and white supremacists, potentially 2,000 counter-protesters, literally trying to fit them in your backyard. It was a volatile mix. And unfortunately, finally, the city sued Wednesday night to move it out of Emancipation Park and put it up in McIntyre Park, which was a much bigger park. And the key to controlling a protest, keep the two sides separated.
Absolutely.
The ACLU sued the city on behalf of the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists to say, no, we're going to keep it here. And unfortunately, 2 days later, on Friday night at 9 o'clock, a judge in Charlottesville sided with the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists. So instead of moving that up to the much bigger park where there could have been good crowd control, it was stuck in Emancipation Park in downtown Charlottesville. It's like your backyard, and you have just signed a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, it's remarkable to read in this book how many times you were stymied every step of the way by, of all things, the Virginia chapter of the ACLU. Do they share some of the blame for what happened?
They absolutely do, and I'm very tough on the book. And listen, I'm all for First Amendment. I say in the book, I love the ACLU, the work they've done in our history. But there are times when if law enforcement, if my colonel, the state police, and the city of Charlottesville and all the other people, it is a volatile situation. People are going to be hurt, and there's going to be damage. That should supersede anything else. And as you read in the book, several members of the National ACLU resigned from the board after Charlottesville. They said, we are not going to be on a board to protect the rights of neo-Nazis. We're not. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate, but you got to balance public safety against freedom of speech. Had we moved it up, they still would have been able to parade around and yell their horrible, you know, every other word was, you know, the F and N word. Every other word was screaming at Jews, saying we're going to burn you like we burned you in Auschwitz. I mean, wow. I'd never in my life, Ben, heard such language. And how did we get to a place like this in America?
And before the main event on Saturday, there was, as you mentioned, this night rally that was unscheduled at the UVA campus, and it resembled the old torchlit Nuremberg rallies. Very scary stuff.
Yep.
And one of your guys on the ground was political science professor Larry Sabato, who a lot of people might recognize as a regular political commentator on cable news. He was one of the first people to alert you to the fact that there was going to be a torchlit rally. Apparently, state authorities were taken totally by surprise. How did that happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. And apparently the Charlottesville police had had heads up that this was going to occur. I think several people at UVA had heard rumors that it was going to occur. Nobody passed that on to the state. So my state police, my National Guard, nobody knew it. And then Brian Moran calls me, my Secretary of Public Safety. He says, you're not going to believe it. There are hundreds of people. And Bennett was frightening. So if you looked up, you know, there's a mountain right outside of UVA of Charlottesville. And all you could see, it was dark out, was this long snake of individuals carrying torches, hundreds of them, screaming, Jews will not replace us, blood and soil, all the sort of things that they chanted in 1933 and 1934 in Germany. It was very similar, and they had swastikas on, very militant, very abusive. The things they said about women, I couldn't even repeat on this radio show. And that was the kickoff. And then they started throwing their torches, and it became chaos. But the state was not even informed of this. And that's why the next morning I had everybody on full alert, all my folks there. I had all my teams there. But we still worked for the city because, remember, we're there in support. Mm-hmm. The city's in charge under Virginia law.
Yeah.
And we have to take orders from the chief of police. But we're there to support, and we were there. But I kept getting reports from Brian Moran all morning and all morning. And finally, Brian Moran, I'll give him a tremendous amount of credit. I was not supposed to call a state of emergency. The city was first, and then I would file suit since I'm there in support. But things got so out of hand at about 11:15, Brian Moran went to Colonel Flaherty and basically said, you got to call the governor. He's got to declare. And I understand Colonel Flaherty, you know, law enforcement likes to work with fellow law enforcement. He was sensitive to the chief of police of Charlottesville. And Brian just said, screw it. And he went out, picked up the phone at about 11:18, called me up and said, governor, you need to call a state emergency. This situation is out of control. I immediately said yes. I immediately authorized a state of emergency and officially signed, gave the verbal and signed the order immediately. And the state police moved to the park and told them they had 11 minutes to disperse, which they did. We cleared the park in 11 minutes, and then the National Guard went in and secured the park. We thought at that point, Ben, everything was fine. No property damage. We'd had fistfights and skirmishes going on, but nothing serious, no serious injuries at this point. And I felt pretty good. So I'd cleared the park, and the rally was over even before it was supposed to begin from noon to 5. But by 11:45 or whatever, the park was clear. And then, boy, about an hour later, couldn't believe it. Brian Moran calls me up, says, you've got the TV on? I said, yes, but they hadn't shown it yet. He said, a car just ran into the crowd. I said, has anybody been killed? He said he didn't know. And then within 10 minutes, the state police got a hold of me and told me that Heather Heyer had been killed, a 32-year-old woman, and injured dozens of people.
Yeah, and aside from the tragic death of Heather Heyer, you and your family also suffered two personal losses that day. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I got to tell you, it was the toughest day of my life. So I had flown down from Northern Virginia. They didn't want me actually on site because you don't want the governor breathing over you. You know, you let your law enforcement do what they need to do. And they knew me very well. I'd wander out in the crowd, and they didn't want security. And so I was in Northern Virginia, and so I flew down on my on a Fairfax helicopter because this Trooper 1, the state police helicopter that I always use, was there doing surveillance. So I landed and had a big motorcade for me with a lot of security because of all the issues going on. And as we began rolling into downtown Charlottesville, the head of my security detail, Mark Wiley, said, there's an aircraft down. That made me a little concerned because as I flew in on the Fairfax County helicopter, they pointed out, they said, Governor, there's Trooper 1, there's your pilot over there doing surveillance. But I didn't see any other aircraft. But you know, maybe at the airport, I had an uneasy feeling. So we continued on, and then I went to go down. We're going to do the press conference. And so I'm in waiting to go out. And because Trump had so, I mean, we haven't really gotten, I mean, Trump fumbled the ball beyond belief when he said it was both sides. And so I knew I had to come out, Ben, that time and speak for Virginia, speak for the country, and speak for the world and tell these neo-Nazis, white supremacist racists to get out of my state, to get out of our country, and there's no place for them here. But just before I went out, and I knew this was going to be a very important speech for me to give because Trump had so fumbled it and had embarrassed the nation and had failed in his moral leadership, they informed me that the helicopter indeed had gone down and that both Lieutenant Jay Cullen, my pilot, and Trooper Pilot Burke Bates, who had been on my security details, had been killed. And it was so hard because Burke Bates had, as I say, you know, part of your personal security detail for the state police, you have 20, they're with you 24/7.
Right.
They're with your kids, they, you know, they hear everything, they see everything, they become part of your family. And I just felt like I had been kicked so hard in the gut. But I knew, Ben, I had to go out with all these cameras and do what I needed to do. I talked to my wife, Dorothy, who was in Northern Virginia. She was just beside herself because, as they say, so close to Burke Bates. And they were there was a lot of concern because my phone had died on the helicopter down. And when the word went down that Trooper 1, the state police helicopter the governor uses, crashed, for a while there they all thought I had gone down in that helicopter. Nobody knew I was in a different helicopter. So the whole was just a very tough. And then, you know, I went up back to Richmond and I went to see the Cullen family and I went to see the Bates family. Both have two young children. It's just, I tell you, Ben, it was, I wish these people had never come into our state. I wish they'd never had the rally. But I will say this, Virginia and Charlottesville, we will come out stronger. They will make us stronger. We're not going to let this hatred hold us back.
Yeah. Did it anger you that all over the world, this was the impression people were getting of the people of your state, even though many, if not most, of these troublemakers actually came from out of state?
Yeah, they did. They came from 35 states. But yeah, this was my, Ben, going back to what I said to you early when they talked about being the center of resistance. Nobody wants this in their state. Nobody wants hatred.
Sure.
It was such a volatile mix, and I hated it. But what I really was bothersome to me was Trump, who I talked to on the phone.
Yeah.
Explained to him what happened. Horrible people in the state. Here's what you need to do. I said, you know, Mr. President, this is an opportunity. I said, Barack Obama had Charleston, Bill Clinton had Oklahoma City, George Bush had 9/11. The world, and especially those of us in America, are looking for moral leadership today to condemn these vile human beings who are saying the most disgusting things. And when I hung up the phone, Ben, I was sure he was going to do the right thing. And then we waited a half an hour, an hour and a half, 2 hours. I was waiting to do my press conference so he could do his. He said he was going to go right out and do it. And I know what happened. The White House got a hold of him. He was up in New Jersey at his golf course up there where he's going to do the press statement. And they got a hold of him. And they said, no, sir, Mr. President, you are not going to condemn neo-Nazis. That's not who you are. So he came out, did not even use the word white supremacist, did not use the word neo-Nazi, and came out and said they were fine people on both sides.
Wow. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Do you think Trump is a racist?
I do. Mm-hmm. I don't say this lightly. I say this because if you look at his deeds and his actions, I mean, look at Elijah Cummings, what he's done to the congressman from Maryland. Look what he's done to the squad. Look what he did to those Muslim countries, banning those seven countries. I mean, I was governor during this time, and families were coming in from these seven countries, U.S. citizens. I went to Dulles Airport because they had detained for hours two young children who were U.S. citizens. They just happened to be coming from one of those countries. The fear with immigration that he's created in this country, the vile send her home, lock her up, the whole what he, the frenzy that he, and the hatred and the division that he's brought out is disgraceful. And yes, and I'll tell you this, we knew he was a racist on Charlottesville. That was his coming out party.
Yeah.
That was him as a dyed-in-the-wool white supremacist, and he is going to attack you if you're from a community of color because you are not an American. You don't belong here. Go home. Let us make this a white country. It's sad.
Yeah. And I also want to mention Congressman John Lewis, who actually wrote the foreword to the book, and you recall meeting with him in the wake of Charlottesville.
Yep.
Did he have some words of inspiration for you?
Well, and I'll tell you, so Monday I'm back in my office in Richmond, and I get my assistant comes in and says, Congressman John Lewis is on the phone. So I pick up the phone, and we say hello, and he said, Governor, I just want you to know that I watched your speech on Saturday night. And he said, I started to cry because your speech moved me. And I thought, Ben, I mean, this is John Lewis, who, leader of civil rights movement, had been beaten up constantly, almost lost his life, calling me to say that thank you for speaking up for those people who did not have a voice. So I went to see John after, and he wrote the foreword in the book, and he's a big part of what I say in the last chapter, how do we go forward beyond Charlottesville? What do we have to do to end racism in this country?
Yeah, and I want to ask you about next steps, not just in Virginia, but also, you know, as head of the National Governors Association.
Sure.
Did you try to get other governors to learn from what happened in Virginia and take action in their own states?
We did, especially, in fact, a couple days after Charlottesville, Charlie Baker, who was the governor of Maryland, called me up and said, what do I do? And I said, Charlie, the one piece of advice I can give you is get control of your permitting process and make sure you keep the two sides separated. If you do that, Ben, then, you know, you got a buffer zone. So after the Boston huge Unite the Right rally, they kept them. I think there was like a mile and a half buffer zone between the two sides. But that's what you have to do. And, you know, Virginia law is very unique because of our history. And the state controls it. We're the Dillon Rule. We're one of the few states left, Dillon Rule, which means no city or county can even determine what their own taxes are. So it's hard in a state like Virginia. But I did talk to the other governors about how we go forward. And as bad as Charlottesville was, it ripped the scab off of racism. I think for far too long, Ben, in our country, people, they're not comfortable talking about race. They're not comfortable talking about the issues of racism. Mm-hmm. They're not comfortable talking about the history in this country. And so for so many people, so many white people, they basically think, well, we dealt with racism. It doesn't exist. Everything's fine. Well, that's not the case. And what Charlottesville did was rip that scab off and say, racism here. And until, Ben, we deal with the issues of inequity in schools, deal with the issues of affordable housing and equities in housing, deal with the criminal justice system, which has many racist elements left in it, deal on the issues of health care, racism is going to continue to exist. So I talk about in the book, like, you can't have inferior school systems. You can't have school systems in African-American communities where the facilities don't have the latest equipment. The facilities may leak or not heat adequately or cool adequately, not have the same quality of teacher, because it's insidious racism that will stay with us. And I tell in my book, I end the book, you know, I don't want to hear about reconciliation commissions anymore. It's a bunch of white people sitting around a room, talking to each other, making themselves feel good. That means nothing.
Yeah. Good
Do
point.
Something. Vote, get out there, lean in, and stop racism in our country.
Well, speaking of voting, we're heading into another presidential election. Why aren't you running for the Democratic nomination?
I thought long and hard. I traveled the country. I really wanted to do it. I thought a Southern Democrat born in New York, who took a huge debt, turned it into a huge surplus, record jobs, and was just a brick wall leaning in to protect women's rights and so forth. I thought it was a good message that worked. And as we got closer, the field got bigger. They had 25. I think Joe Biden was a little bit probably in a similar space to mine, Ben. But the other thing is, you know, as you know, we had issues in Virginia with our governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general. And we have elections this year. And for the first time in 26 years, we could win the House, Senate, and have the governor. I had to make a decision. Do I get in here with a narrow window? Or do I come back home where, you know, everybody's asking me to come back and take over things and run them so we can win? I decided to do what I thought was where I could make the biggest impact. Mm-hmm. Something I've always done in my life. I'll go. It isn't about me. And in fairness, I think some of these candidates who are running for president maybe should have run for the Senate. But, you know, I got to go where I think I can make the biggest impact on life, and that was going home to Virginia.
Mm-hmm. We're heading into the second Dem debate, and I wonder, as former chair of the DNC, what do you think Democratic voters are going to be looking for in a candidate?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know what they're looking for? A, someone who can beat Trump. But B, more importantly, and I've been vocal on this, Ben. I've been dissatisfied with the first debate. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're addressing issues that the American public deals with every single day. You know, I never heard K-12 mentioned. I never heard infrastructure mentioned. I never heard cybersecurity mentioned. I never heard workforce development mentioned. We spent an inordinate amount of time chasing these shiny objects like Medicare for All or the New Green Deal. People sitting at home saying, well, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to lose my private insurance? We spent all this time saying that immigrants can come to this country. We're not going to charge them with any crime. Then we spent a time talking about how we can give every immigrant health care. And I understand we've got to take care of everybody. But this is what our debate was all about. And then they hear that, well, I may lose my health care because I got private insurance and under Medicare. So wait a minute, I'm going to lose my insurance. And we spent all this time. We're going to give it. Obviously, the folks coming in the country, something's wrong here. So yeah. Let us lean in. People, I want a question. How are you going to fix prescription drug costs? I'm a father with a family of four, let's say. Tell me right now how you're going to bring the cost of these prescription drugs down. Give me a very specific way you're going to do it. What are you going to do on infrastructure? Give me specifics. So I don't like to be overly negative because I'm a very optimistic person, but the Democrats better start leaning in and quit dealing with these ideological litmus tests and tell voters what you're going to do for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the last part, they need to tell people, because of Charlottesville and other issues, how do we heal and how do we unite?
Yeah.
And I think those are the three big things that I want to see out of the upcoming debates.
Yeah. Good advice. Well, again, the book is called Beyond Charlottesville, Taking a Stand Against White Nationalism. Governor Terry McAuliffe, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks, Ben. Great to be with you.
Thanks again to Terry McAuliffe for coming on the show. Order his new book, Beyond Charlottesville, Taking a Stand Against White Nationalism, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And follow him on Twitter at Terry McAuliffe. Do your career goals require you to take a standardized test like GRE, GMAT, LSAT, MCAT, or SAT? Magoosh Online Test Prep provides you with the tools you need to get a great score, like study schedules, up-to-date practice questions, video lessons, and support from expert tutors. Study anywhere, anytime, on desktop or mobile. Visit Magoosh, MAGOOSH.com, and enter promo code KICKASS for a 15% off discount. Be sure to subscribe to KICKASS News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to KickAss News.